Welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Ramita Iyer, research analyst at the Institute. The Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or IPEF, a group of 14 countries led by the US, was launched in May last year. As a non-traditional economic arrangement that does not offer market access concessions and tariff liberalization, the IPEF presents a blueprint to a new but untested kind of economic engagement in the region. Given that the IPEF has now made robust progress with the substantive conclusion of Pillar 2 on supply chains, South Asia Chat is running a three-part series that discusses the decisions delivered by the IPEF until now and examines the prospects of its further progress. In this first part, we have an expert from Australia, Professor Peter Draper, Professor and Executive Director of the Institute for International Trade in the School of Economics and Public Policy, University of Adelaide, Australia. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ramita. It's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
So in the ministerial meeting held in Detroit in late May, it was announced that the supply chain agreement has been finalized. Do you think that the outcomes achieved from Pillar 2 will be an effective prescription for supply chain resilience in the region?
I think, Ramita, the short answer is that it remains to be seen. So this agreement or this pillar was concluded very quickly. Essentially, what we have is a framework agreement. So there's no real binding provisions within it. No dispute settlement, for instance. This is not a traditional trade agreement by any stretch of the imagination. It's a cooperative agreement. So it will be as useful as the partners continue to desire to continue to cooperate on these issues. And that depends on the amount of benefits it delivers and how each partner perceives those benefits relative to the efforts required. But that said, what the agreement does do is it establishes, I think, a fairly unique institutional structure designed to secure ongoing cooperation and collaboration. So it sets up three, boards or councils. The first is the IPEF Supply Chain Council. So that'll be the overall driver of this particular agreement. It'll discuss the general issues, which supply chains are of most concern to all the members, what needs to be done to promote resilience, matters like that. It also establishes the IPEF Supply Chain Crisis Response Network, and that would be more reactive, obviously, than proactive, whereas the Supply Chain Council is more proactive. So the Supply Chain Crisis Response Network aims to respond quickly and flexibly in the event of, say, a Fukushima-like crisis or another pandemic, etc. And then it also establishes the IPEF Labour Rights Advisory Board, and that really reflects not just the Biden administration's concerns with labour rights, because I think in the Australian context there's the strong support for more firmly embedding labour rights issues into trade agreements, but it's particularly a Biden administration concern since they have adopted what they call a worker-centric trade policy.
So just a quick follow-up, because Australia is involved in a number of supply chain initiatives, including the one with the UK and another one with India and Japan. Do you see the IPEF being complementary to these efforts?
Yes, I think there is widespread consensus in Australia that we need to build supply chain resilience, broadly defined. Whether that's future-proofing vis-a-vis potential new pandemics, so pharmaceutical supply chains, for instance, or the health supply chains related to that, such as PPE, equipment, masks, etc., that could be one side of the equation. There's also another side, which is more about the military security dimension. And I think the India-Japan agreement goes more in that direction. So that's about securing future supplies of critical minerals that are critical to a whole range of military applications, but not only military applications. if one thinks of rare earths, for instance, and their centrality in the IT value chain, which Japan is particularly concerned about. And then similarly with the UK, it's defence related, it's pharmaceutical related, it's a range of things. So in principle, they're quite complementary. And I think from the Australian point of view, the more partners we have to build supply chain resilience, the better.
So apart from supply chains, progress has also been made in the other three pillars on trade, clean economy and fair economy. And it is anticipated that the IPEF will be concluded in November 2023 in time for the APEC summit. Given this timeline, what are your expectations from the remaining three pillars over the next few months?
So I think the trade pillar is the trickiest. That's because it would involve binding commitments. It's trickiest when it comes to the digital trade issues in particular. And what I'm hearing is that from the standpoint of US business, thinking big IT companies in particular, they see the way the Biden administration is approaching this particular pillar as being, I'll use a term and then explain it, USMCA minus. So the USMCA is the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the revised NAFTA agreement, for those that can still remember what NAFTA was. But the digital trade provisions in the USMCA are regarded from a US business point of view as being the most robust. They're looking to improve on those. However, the Biden administration's emphasis on a worker-centric trade agenda and bringing the trade unions, civil society groups, etc., into the IPEF process, has meant a watering down of those USMCA provisions, as they said. So this affects things like free flow of data, where data should be stored, so local storage requirements, and those two in particular. So US businesses worried that the Biden administration is lowering the bar, and hence that they seem to be, from my estimation, in the process of withdrawing support. I'm hearing similar noises in the Australian case from the US branches or the Australian branches of those US companies, as well as some Australian companies. So I think there's still quite a big question mark about the future of that trade pillar, and particularly the digital trade agreement provisions. I'm not sure that those can be resolved in time for the APEC summit. They're politically very difficult, not just in the US, but also elsewhere. Then the pillar three negotiations are less controversial. That essentially concerns the clean economy provisions. So this is about making clean economy related trade and investment more user friendly and elevating it up the regional radar. Everybody agrees this needs to be done. It looks quite different whether you're in India or in Australia, depending on how far down the clean energy transition track you are. So I think what remains to be seen is what particularly developing country partners would be expected to commit to in relation to potential trade and particularly investment benefits they might expect to receive from this pillar. Now, those texts haven't been released, so we don't know exactly what's being discussed, but my sense is it would take quite an innovative approach. So be more project-focused, more trade and investment facilitation-focused and cooperative, but certainly not binding, and with potential aid and finance flows linked to all of that. That could be ready in time for APEC because it would be a cooperative agreement like the pillar two that's just been concluded. And then the fair economy pillar, so far as I can make out, is essentially about reinforcing existing multilateral codes and norms. A lot of those are anchored in the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is really leading global tax-related, but also to some extent corruption-related initiatives. And many, certainly developed countries, have signed up to these codes. They would like developing countries to do the same. So in the IPEF context, again, it would be for the developing countries to make that calculation. What is it going to cost me to sign up to this vis-a-vis the potential benefits? But in principle, those codes are already there. They know what they're dealing with and all are participating. So I don't expect this would be a particularly controversial pillar, and it could be ready in time for APEC as well.
We're focusing more closely on Pillar 3, which is on clean economy. Could you share on Australia's position, interests, issues and challenges here?
Sure. So the Australian Labor Party, which is the governing party in this particular political cycle, has strongly emphasised that Australia needs to make the clean economy transition, so the green transition, if you like, and it's put in place this quite a robust policy package designed to deliver that outcome. So they're investing in things like hydrogen, green hydrogen, particularly thinking very carefully about how those would be geared towards helping domestic industries, particularly heavy industries, to decarbonize, so the linkages between the two. And then with those industries having decarbonized, but also potentially having a lot of clean hydrogen to export, how those products, the ensuing products, could be traded into the region. So from the Australian government's point of view, and I think this is more or less supported in the business community, maybe we can get to that shortly, it's a mixed picture. There are opportunities in the clean energy transition, and they want to harness those opportunities. Now, given that the Pillar 3 negotiations will focus primarily on cooperative frameworks and establishing common standards, much of the debate would be in relation to whose standards and what do they look like and how will they facilitate exports from Australia, but also potentially inward investment into Australia in a range of, say, critical minerals that are critical to the green energy transition. So Australia has a lot of opportunities in that space. And they'll be looking for the IPEF's clean economy pillar to buttress, if you like, or cement those opportunities in a common regulatory environment. So bringing a number of trade and investment partners into the mix.
An important factor in ensuring that deals are effective is ensuring that the interests of the stakeholders within the member countries are met. In this light, could you share the perceptions of the businesses and civil society in Australia towards the IPEF?
So there's perceptions about the IPEF as a whole, and then perceptions about each individual pillar. So I'll tackle it at those two levels. So when it comes to the IPEF as a whole, my sense is that there is a consensus amongst all stakeholders that we need to be engaged in this process, that we need to support and obviously influence it to the extent that we can, largely because what the IPEF does is it brings the US back into the region. Your listeners might remember the US left the then Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Donald Trump signed that on his first day in office, took the US out of the TPP, and the US has not really been engaged in regional trade conversations since, outside of APEC, which is also a cooperative framework. That's another issue, by the way. How does IPEF relate to APEC? But maybe we can get into that later. So because this, the IPEF brings the US back in a relatively meaningful way, and with Australia being a core security partner for the US and the region, Australian stakeholders are very supportive. So yes, we support the IPEF at a general strategic level for that reason. However, when you start to break down what the IPEF is and isn't, you see a lot more variation. So again, more generally, I would say business is, depending which business group you speak to, right? But the apex business organizations, I won't name them, but let's say those groups that cover the entirety of the Australian economy, they're quite sceptical about what the IPEF might ultimately deliver, largely because it isn't a traditional free trade agreement. And the traditional Australian emphasis has been on negotiating wide-ranging agreements with very deep commitments in them, deep with respect to liberalisation of goods and services trade particularly, but also rules of regulatory commitments, a whole range of them. That's absent from IPEF. So from that point of view, it's not going to be as commercially meaningful as, say, a trade agreement with the European Union or with the UK as just concluded, or indeed with the United States, which Australia already has, and similarly Japan, etc. So we have bilateral trade agreements with most of the IPEF partners already. In Australian business, these APEX groups are asking, what's the value add? But when you look into the individual pillars, and let's start with pillar three, there you'll find very specific business groups that do support it. So for instance, the Hydrogen Council was on board with pillar three because they see opportunities for exporting hydrogen into the region and for attracting investments into Australian hydrogen production in Australia. So quite a specific interest, much more in support. Then for the other pillars, so on pillar one, and I've already mentioned that there's some groups that are quite skeptical of the digital trade or the potential digital trade provision outcomes. Then if you switch to the other side of the equation and you look at civil society groups and labor unions, I would say their concerns are largely focused on pillar one, and particularly those digital trade provisions. And they have different concerns to the business groups. So whereas the business groups want commercially meaningful outcomes, the labor unions and civil society groups are more, if you like, European in their orientation. They want much stronger consumer protections, much stronger competition provisions, for instance. They want to regulate business and put it back in the box, so to speak. And they worry that that pillar one might be too ambitious. So a very opposite concern. I think their concerns are overplayed, but one can see where they are coming from. And then again, it depends which other pillar you're looking at. So pillar two on supply chain resilience, I think everybody's on board with that. We all need to, we'll recognize the need post-pandemic, post-China's economic coercion of Australia, to promote diversification, supply chain resilience. And then pillar four, I haven't really encountered any opposition. Within Australia, domestic stakeholders are broadly on board with promoting good governance in the region. The Australian Foreign Aid Program has long supported that goal and an objective. And so pillar four is largely in keeping with that consensus, I would say. So it's not controversial in the Australian context.
Finally, I want to focus a bit more on one of the things that you mentioned, which is that the IPEF marks the re-entry of the US in this part of the world after the Trump administration withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The geopolitical dimension seems to be another important force that is driving the larger pivot to the Indo-Pacific region. And the IPEF is being viewed as a tool to reassert the US economic engagement and perhaps provide an alternative to the Chinese-led economic order. Given that the IPEF is positioned as a framework that can make the region resilient through de-risking, in a broader sense, what is your impression of the arrangement being an effective geopolitical strategy?
How effective it would be, we'll have to wait and see, because it depends what it delivers. So it has delivered something in the supply chain space, but a lot of detail still has to be worked through and worked out. So we'll see ultimately what that delivers. To the extent that it does deliver, and particularly meaningful outcomes that would support this geopolitical framing, clearly. The pillar one, the trade pillar, we'll have to see whether it concludes in the first place, and secondly, whether the business gets behind it, because at the end of the day, governments can conclude cooperative frameworks, but if business doesn't come to the party, they're essentially just documents that remain on the virtual shelf, so to speak. Nobody's actually going to use them. So they wouldn't be particularly useful. In my sense, the trade pillar might be heading more in that direction, but it's still early days. We'll see, ultimately. The clean energy one is the one I'm most interested in. Look, I think the supply chain could potentially be meaningful, but similarly, so could the clean energy one. It harnesses the moment. It speaks very much to what the Biden administration is doing domestically through its Inflation Reduction Act subsidies in particular. So the US is pouring billions of US dollars into its green energy transition. I think all the partners in IPEF see opportunity to get access to some of those subsidies. However, there's a price to be paid, particularly for the developing country partners, which is the US will say, these are our standards, these are our criteria you have to meet. If you do, potentially investments, maybe access to the IRA could flow, and the IRA subsidies could flow from that. And if they do, that just locks the US more firmly into the regional economic architecture. And so in a geopolitical sense, from the US standpoint, I think also from the Australian standpoint, that would be a useful outcome in that broader context of de-risking from China, particularly, but also diversifying in a more general sense, trade and investment partners, which I think all countries want to do.
Peter, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.